it was all a pipe dream, watching bodyboarding up on TV. Deep at reef, watching tension repeats, eating bakery feeds at 18, living the dream with no sunscreen. Yeah, we were so keen, surfing Aussie pipe, buying Riptide, eating shit pipe.
G'day and welcome to the Riptide Bodyboarding Podcast, the home of bodyboarding. Thank you for joining us on episode 81 of our verbal journaling, and I'm your host, Luke O'Connor. Today's guest is one tall, lanky, handsome man. He's a man that throws himself into some of the largest caves known to the bodyboarding world. He's really made a name for himself over the last 3 or 4 years, now located in the west coast of Oz, originally hailing from Tassie. He's a good egg. He's a fucking great bloke, actually, and I had a lot of fun hanging out with him on the east coast recently for the Shark Island Challenge. He edits all his own clips with his brother. He has made some real big, some big kind of waves to the bodyboarding community from recent edits such as Coco Gone West and From Dusk Till Dawn, sponsored by Pride, Nymph, Good Earth, and I think I'm forgetting one, but I'm sure we'll touch on that in the podcast. I'd like to introduce Cohen Thomas to the potty. Cohen, man, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's epic to finally jump on board after listening to so many episodes.
Oh, brah, thank you, man. Yeah, I've been meaning to chat to you for ages, dude, and obviously it was great having you over East here, as I just alluded to in the intro. Like, it was great to have all you boys over from Tassie, you know, Sam, your brother, yourself, Harley and Charles. You guys made such a good vibe for the time you're over here, and obviously caught some waves up and down the coast, and we got to hang out and do some ice baths and some saunas and just talk shit and drink some beers. So, yeah, it was really good. So let's start with your trip on the East Coast, man. What did you guys get up to, and what was your thoughts on the whole trip?
Yeah, I mean, gee, it was a massive trip. I think I was away for 2 months all up. But yeah, started the trip with Sam flying over to WA, and we basically packed up my car and drove to the desert and spent about a month out there with a couple other friends. So that was a perfect way to start the trip because we're surfing heaps, you know, every single day. And then from there, once we got the orange light from you boys, we kind of punched it over and, yeah, did a 24-hour drive from South Oz to Cronulla. And
that's always a crushing drive, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Sammy actually wasn't with me for that, but he actually flew home and just did a week of work before I went over there. And my girlfriend ended up meeting me in Sejuna, and then we punched it over, and it was pretty sweet. I mean, we gave ourselves heaps of time, so it's kind of fun sometimes getting on the road and doing those kind of trips. But my car was so full, like, we couldn't sleep in it, so we're staying at these pretty rogue little stops on the way.
What was a pretty good time. So, yeah, I mean, I can imagine. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to know, dude, what was it like staying at some of those hotels and motels? Because there's some classic ones coming back on the Hume Highway that I can only imagine you'd visited.
Yeah, yeah. No, they were epic. I mean, they feel, especially after being out in the desert so long, like, any room and hot shower is going to be that good. But, yeah, pretty pricey for what you're getting over there. Like, one of them was $160, and I don't even think I had a roof on it.
You got, like, air whistling through it. You get, like, condensation from the aircon or whatever it is. There's nothing in the bar fridge. You're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty rogue. But, no, they're epic, and they definitely make a good memory out of staying in those places. So, yeah, it was good.
Sick, man. And come along with your chick too. I got to meet Kira. She's a lovely girl, man. And you know, all the time spent coming back across from the desert, yarning in the car, and you know, just working out travel plans and stuff, it really strengthens your kind of relationship, hey? Because I've done it with my missus a lot, and wow, man, there's some good times, some bad times, and there's everything in between.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was good. Definitely a lot of time in the car together, but yeah, we made it work. It was fine, but just my car was so full. It was just not that user-friendly. I mean, I was moving all my life from WA back to Tassie on this big trip, and, yeah, there was just so much extra stuff that you just wouldn't usually bring on that kind of trip. So, yeah, ideally we're going to try to sleep in the car, but it was just so full.
Fuck, I didn't know that. So you were bringing everything back from West Oz. So you're finishing your time up there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even have a car over here. I'm just living out of my bodyboard bag at the moment. It's just, this was my last week here in the West before I head overseas for a bit. So yeah, it was basically me moving all my stuff back to Tassie, as well as, you know, doing that trip to South Oz and then also going to Cronulla for the comp. So it was like pretty jam-packed.
Jesus, man. So you've done like a full, you know, just unstrap the boots, pick up your whole life and then move it back to its original location and prepping for the next kind of stage. That would have been even more added pressure coming across the desert and then over to the East Coast. That would have made it a real eventful drive, eh?
Yeah, it was actually really stressful. It was so much to organize, like moving out of a place, because I've been in WA 5 years now, so I have a lot of stuff. Like, I couldn't even fit it all in the car, you know. I had to box some stuff up and got to send that back separately. But yeah, it was like a big process of getting ready to kind of go away and stuff. So yeah, it's been a bit of a headache, but we got it done in the end. But yeah, my car was just so full, it made it really tricky at times. Like, me and Sam had to bring an additional tent with us, so just when we stopped somewhere, we could set up a tent and just throw boards and compressors and tools and just, yeah, everything in there.
That's so epic to hear, because I know I've had that many a time on trips where, like, you get a hire car or you just you're filled to the brim with a van or whatever, and you've got to put things underneath the car or rearrange things every time you sleep. And I mean, it's obviously a hassle at the time, but you get really good at Lego packing and making sure everything's jam packed in there, like Pac-Man. You know what I mean? It's crazy, like living out of a car, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like Tetris every single time you stop. But you never calculate for how many beers you're going to get or you're shopping and stuff, and then you're fully packed and then you know, you go to the bottle-o and then you go to the supermarket and it's just carnage.
Yeah, for sure, especially the way you boys drink beers. A couple of West End cartons in there.
Yeah, a couple of West Ends, a lot of West End cartons. Cooper's too, though. Cooper's had a strong appearance throughout the whole trip as well, so you got to mix up a little bit, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Especially, you know, when in Rome, mate, when you're in South Oz, you got to sample the nectar of the gods over there, and that is Cooper's. Been around since 1862, bros.
I know. I think we sampled a couple reds at Mark and Cassie's that one afternoon.
We did. What a great afternoon that was, eh? Like, I mean, I wish we stayed for a bit longer, and I knew there was a couple of swells coming the weeks following, but it's always good just to hang out at that joint and just have a yarn and like, you know, drink the afternoon away, because it just seems like the Wild West out there, and, you know, when you've got signs above your head saying shop guarded by loaded shotgun or whatever it is, and, you know, we didn't see Mark that afternoon. Kathy made us some burgers and brought the beers, but, like, whenever you get to run into some locals, if they're good or they're bad, you know, you get definitely get a mixed bag out there. It's always eventful, eh? It's such a good time in the des.
Oh, always. It feels lawless when you're out there, especially when you're, you know, out west or something where there's really no one around. It's crazy. But I only saw Mark once the whole trip when I was there, which was pretty rare for staying 5 weeks out there. I think you see him less and less each time. It's a bit sad.
It is, yeah. And we got to meet him on the first day we were there. Run into him again. We've been lucky enough to have a couple of yarns with him over the years. But, like, there's been some stories floating around, and Dane Woods told me this the other day, and I don't know how true it is, but I'm definitely willing to repeat it to make, you know, possibly make a good story out of it. But supposedly, because, you know, he's got lots of land out the back now.
Yeah. I mean, he's subdivided a fair bit. I know he's sold a lot of areas to, like, people from Adelaide and local fellas too. They've definitely bought land out the back.
Yeah. It's full, like, there's some good setups. There's also some shanty setups and stuff, but he's definitely making it work. And Woods was telling me he's been a bit more low-key recently because there was I don't know if you remember in the drag videos, there was a guy sitting at, like, at the front of the bar there with Mark. He was like, looked like a garden gnome almost, like, really overweight, huge grey beard.
He drives a four-wheeler.
Yes. So word has it on the coast is that him and Mark got into a dispute because old mate called the, I believe it was the authorities on like how Mark was either subdividing the land, or maybe there was like a health and safety issue with some of the upkeep of the kitchen and the food and all this kind of stuff. Oh no, it was the cats. This is what Woodsy said. Sorry, I was just racking my brain. You have the, you know how Kathy's got all those cats in there, bruh?
Oh yeah, she doesn't know how many she's got, but there's a lot.
Fuck, there's a lot of cats. I remember when she was serving some beers, there was cats running everywhere, and I can only imagine what they're doing in the kitchen. I don't give a fuck. I'm happy to eat their burgers and have a good time, you know. Like, I'm happy to support them, and they're just good people. So I'm like, you know, whatever. But they've always been nice to us. I know there's been some other stuff, some controversy surrounding, but they've been always cool to us. And, yeah, supposedly he complained about the cats. And then, man, after that went down, him and Mark had a falling out. And then 2 months later, I'm pretty sure this is legit. So again, don't anyone hold me to my word. This is what I've heard from good old Dane Woods, is, and he's in the know with a lot of these people because he spent a bit of time over South Oz before we were even there, and he's obviously done a lot of time over there too. He said that old mate was found in his property, burnt alive in the corner, and he is no longer with us after that dispute went down.
I believe every word of that story because I was there a week after it happened, actually. And yeah, it was there's an ominous vibe around that area, and yeah, a lot of allegations of what actually happened. Some people were saying that he used to leave the wood heater on, and yeah, he's fallen asleep on the couch, and the wood heater was known to spit out all sorts of flames or heat or something, and yeah, it burnt the place down. And then there was allegations that he had a heart attack in the house, and then the wood heater burnt the house down. But yeah, all of it's a bit up in the air, I guess. You never really, really know what happened. But yeah, he was a really, really nice guy when I got to hang out with him. You know, he came, picked us up when we went fishing once, and we hopped on his four wheeler, and yeah, he had some good stories to tell. So it's definitely a bit shocked when I found out he'd passed away under strange circumstances, we could say.
For sure, man. Suspicious, strange, whatever you like to call it. Like, you're so right in saying the lawless Wild West before. Like, you know, and even Mark talking about previously, you know, rightly or wrongly, if he was under the influence of some sort of substance, speaking about how he has actually killed and buried people out the back because of previous disputes. You know, you can't say... These are all allegations, and I'm obviously just speaking like kind of tongue in cheek here, but bro, like it's very unusual, and with his record and everything that has happened out there, it's yeah, it's just fascinating to dissect it all and think about it. It's almost like a fucking true crime scene kind of investigation. You know what I mean? Like it's a yeah, you could make a TV show out of it. That's what I'm kind of getting at. There's just so much going on out there for such a, you know, deserted, unpopulated area. There is a lot of politics happening on that stretch of coast there at Chiringa.
Oh yeah, it's a wild time. Like, I remember talking to my friend Callum. This is many years ago because Callum was living in Smoky Bay, and he was spending a lot of time hanging out with Mark. You know,
oysters, bro.
Oysters, yeah, oysters. Loved oysters, but yeah, he was working on the oyster farm out there, and He'd always go and hang out with Mark after he went surfing around that way, and he just loved it because he's like, you go to the shop and you never know what you're gonna get. And like, he'd get there sometimes and Mark would say, we're gonna go chop wood, and he'd hop in Mark's car and they'd just go on this crazy adventure to go chop wood, and you just wouldn't know what, you know, where the day's gonna turn to. And yeah, it's definitely exciting times when you're with Mark, but I've never had a bad time hanging out with him, so.
Oh, never, man. Yeah, he's always been so kind to bodyboarders and surfers alike, and he's always give you pretty cheap accommodation. Obviously, they haven't been cleaned out in ages, those old caravans out in the back when they were there, but, like, there was always somewhere to stay. The beer was cold. They, you know, do your favours and open up early or stay up late and stuff. And, yeah, they're absolute legends, and I hope they don't sell the place and hold on to it forever. But another story with Mark, and I don't know if I've told this on the podcast before, but I'll just rehash it really quickly. Like, one of the first times we went in 2009, Sean Pine got his dad's people mover, this old like Mazda MDV or something. I can't remember what it was, but it could fit eight people in. And five of us went over. It was myself, Ryan Hart, Sam Strachan, Pino, Aylett, and Kyle Buchanan. So six of us. And Kyle and Sam Aylett were just shooting, and three or four of us would surf in a middle at different times and whatever. And, obviously be careful not to rock up in certain spots with that many dudes, because obviously we know what the locals are like down there, and you want to respect them and stuff. Fully understand that, because they surf alone all the time. But when we went over, we ended up at the Roadhouse and we got chatting to him, and that's when Mark was in his full drug craze haze kind of times. Like he was loving life and had a lot going on. And he got talking to us and he's like, "Wait, you guys got any time tomorrow?" And we're like, "Yeah," in between swells. I think it was an onshore day or whatever. We're there for 10 days in total, I think. And he goes, "Well, I got this Hilux down in Port Lincoln. I need someone to pick it up for me." And I'm thinking to myself, it's fucking strange. Like, just go down and get it yourself. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, someone could just drop you down, then you could just drive back up. It's like, it's only like an hour or so away and whatever. And he's like, "Yeah, if you guys go down and get it, you can have it for the week. You can use it to go to the beach, go fishing and stuff like that. And then, it'll be all good." And we're like, fuck, that's amazing. Because we had like a people mover van, like I said before. So there's no way to access the beach or no way to go to, certain waves around the area that we all know you need four drives for. And then we go, okay, so we've just been not naive 18, 19-year-olds. We're like, fuck it. Yeah, okay, sweet. We drove down to Port Lincoln. Got to this dude's property outside of Port Lincoln. Man, I couldn't believe what we did and how and what actually occurred, because when we got there, the vibe was crazy. It was just this weird dude coming out, like giving us the one eye, blah, 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 blah. And then, sorry if you keep hearing messages in the background, I've got that many fucking group chats going, I can't actually...
Oh, no, that's right. I thought it was me. I just got up and was...
it's a fucking nightmare. But and anyway, so we met this dude. He was real just odd and off-putting and whatever, and we ended up just getting the car. And two of us drove the people mover back, and the other four hopped in the Hilux. We just cruised back to Mark's, no dramas, thing drove well, you know what I mean, just for an old Forby. And he's like, "Oh, sweet, you got it back, sweet. I'll just need it for a couple of hours and you can have it this afternoon." And we're like, "Why the fuck do you need it for a couple of hours? Like, what do you do? He's like, "Oh, I just got to check it out." And I'm like, "Yeah, it was sweet, no dramas." Obviously, you just do what Mike says. And then he definitely ripped the back seats open, and there was fucking gear in that car. I don't know what was in there. I don't know what narcotics or amphetamines were in there, but he definitely had something in that car that he wanted to get out before we were using again. And essentially, we did a drug run without knowing for Mark and Kathy in 2009. And I could not believe it. Looking, it took us years to fully dissect that and understand, and then we got to know Mark better. Yeah, and then I was like, holy shit, he just played us as fools, which we were at that age, and got away with, people just doing his dirty work for him. And doff of the cap to Mark, he played it really well.
Yeah, he's a crafty one, that's for sure. Did you piece it together that trip or?
Nah, man, unfortunately not, eh? Unfortunately not, man. We had really no idea at the time, and we used the car, we dropped it back, never got pulled over by the cops, nothing like that. We didn't actually see any cops that trip, so maybe that was the case, because I'm sure those number plates would have been red hot. But cruised on, went home, and then only years went by, and we kept talking about it, and it was brought up a couple of times. And I think someone suggested, "Oh, you guys did a drug run," just jokingly. And then knowing Mark and Kathy more and more, it was like, we probably did a drug run. You know what I mean? Like, we definitely did a drug run.
I think I know the car you're talking about. I think I went and chopped wood in that car one time. It was kind of like a dark kind of blue Hilux, hey?
Yeah, there was a dark blue one for sure. We had a white one this time. I know he'd probably gone through many a car, but you know how there was like a graveyard out the back?
Yeah, I know the graveyard out the back, yes.
Yeah, I think it was just kind of mangled in there by the end, or, you know, he probably decided to blow it up one night when he was on the gear, just having fun with some blokes out the back. You know, he did some crazy stuff. I remember even, I think Maddox told a story once of supposedly him catching salmon that day, because he was a really good fisherman, and having an absolute bender that night with some of the fellas. And they were staying, I think Maddox, Casey, and a couple other crew were staying in, maybe Tom Robb was staying in one of the caravans out the back, and he came in at midnight, and kicked the door open. Fireworks, and I think he put it inside a salmon. And blew up the salmon inside the thing. Again, this is might be Chinese whispers, or the story might have been inflated. But, yeah, definitely fireworks, and I dare say fish was involved too, because it only matches up him being a really good fisherman. And I just, you know, you just never knew what you were going to get. You're so right. You never knew what you were going to get with Mark and Kathy.
Oh, it was just, yeah, it's just crazy times going in there. You almost take it for granted now because, yeah, the times he's up and about is getting fewer and fewer. But yeah, he was an absolute pocket rocket, like crafty guy, and you never knew. Ivan Milant vibes all the time, but always cheeky, always had a smile on his face, and you know, always making the boys laugh. It was good. It's always good
going in. Oh, for sure. You would lock into a conversation, and you'd always get so much out of him. He was always willing to give stuff too. He's a cool egg, but. We were talking about your, obviously we talk so much about South Oz and West Oz, but we were talking about your trip over to East. So we got through all the crazy hotels and motels on the way over because your car was packed to the brims, and then you've made it over East. And what was the next step?
We came into Cronulla and basically drove straight to the apartment, which you boys helped us get, and it was right on Shark Island, which was crazy because I've actually never been to Shark Island before in my life. So driving down into Cronulla and then arriving at the apartment and seeing it right there from the balcony, you know, a 20 meter walk from our front doorstep, and you're pretty much in the water, was so crazy. So every morning we're just waking up and literally Shark Island would be right there on our doorstep. So yeah, arrived in Cronulla and met up with Harley and my friend Caden, who I believe you met too. So those boys were from West Oz, and yeah, basically checked into the apartment and soaked it all in. Got a look at Shark Island for the first time. It was very memorable. It was crazy to see it.
Dude, that apartment was sick. Yeah, you nailed it snapping up that because, yeah, you were right next to it. You're right next to the comp site, which was ideal too, because I can just remember throughout the broadcast, like there was a 10-second delay, but oh my goodness, man, when you saw waves coming through and one of the four Tasmanians, the Tasmanians were lighting up the reef, the cheers and the yells and the energy that was coming from that apartment during that time was so good. It lifted the vibe so much, man. It was like being at we were at a live sporting event, but it really gave that background atmosphere, and you guys got around it. And that's what I love so much about having all four of you guys there. Like, you obviously all bring so much to the comp, and you've got great skills, all four of you, but the energy and the camaraderie that you guys brought was fucking sick. And having two sets of brothers there, all from Tasmania, was pretty special.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, I don't know if that's ever happened before. I mean,
never, yeah. I don't reckon.
I mean, the Oberon brothers and Ben and Toby, they may have been in event together. So I guess there's sets of brothers, but definitely not all from Tassie. So it was like kind of pinching myself when it all lined up that we're all in the comp and all that. And then on top of that, like all our mates flying up from Tassie and kind of surprising us for it too. Like some of my best friends are there that I hadn't seen in probably 2 years and just rocked up 2 days before the comp. It was crazy. It was crazy. It was hard not to drink heaps of beers then before the comp and all that.
I know, you're just in such a good vibe and you're in like a little, like, you know, you're still in a coastal town, but you are just on the edge of the city. So, like, there's that hum and buzz. You can kind of go out and do whatever you want any night of the of the week, it's always there to tempt you. So fully getting, especially having Jeff Swan there, that man can drink 1,000 beers. He'd be G'ing it up from day one.
Oh, absolutely. Like the first day he came into the apartment, I think it was 3 days before the comp, and he hadn't slept from the night before. I think he arrived and got on the beers with Gleason, and then all of a sudden he came to it, and he was on the sidewalk in front of Shark Island at them cafes getting margaritas in the morning with his bodyboard bag still with him. Hadn't even checked into his apartment. And then he came back to mine, and then, you know, four of my friends from Tassie just rocked up, and yeah, they kept going. They didn't stop. I think they went on a 3 day bender as soon as Swanee got there.
That's epic.
Yeah, he can definitely drink a lot of people under the table, and such good value all the time. So yeah,
I was so surprised at the after party at Sam Van's after we had the presentation at Colonel Rec Club that he just looked like fresh as a daisy. And to find out that he's like in his 40s, I'm like, fuck off, man. You look incredible for your age, and you're sinking piss left, right, and center, like, and everything else. Like, what are you doing? What's the magic trick? You know, what's the elixir to life? He just doesn't seem to age. Almost like a Benjamin fucking Button.
Yeah, I know. He does not look how old he is. I mean, he's not old, but like, yeah, I always thought he was just like 35. And I thought that for like 10 years probably. It wasn't until the other day when he told me how old he was. I was like, oh, really? Yeah, it took me by surprise.
Yeah, which, you know, 40 or like in your 40s isn't old, but just when you look at him, he looks like late 20s, early 30s. Like he looks incredibly well. Like shout out to Jeff Swan down on Maria Island? Is that where he's at?
Maria Island, yeah, that's where he's working out with the Wombats up in the hills.
Fuck, I love his Instagram, man. Sometimes I just stare at his stories all day just because some of the stuff he puts up is, he obviously is in a very special part of the world and a very secluded part of the world, and not having so much human contact, he can kind of just cruise about his day and just take in all the glory of nature around him. And fuck, it's pretty special, eh?
So cool. I mean, then you can't even take a car to that island. I mean, I think he might have a car there, maybe. But, yeah, you basically get a ferry over and you can have a push bike, and that's about it. So it's super untouched. It's really, really cool.
That's sick. And so all the boys are up there. You guys were carrying on. You had a couple of warm-up surfs before the 10 to 15-foot death challenge on the 16th of June. What was your impressions of the island and Cronulla at the time?
Well, when I first got there, we surfed it probably 3 or 4 times before the comp, but it was small. It was only like 3 foot, maybe max 4 foot on the set. So it was hard to like get a gauge of what it's going to do when it's, you know, really, really big. I just felt like it was breaking really close to the inside ledge, more so than when if it was bigger, it would probably break out maybe a little bit further than the ledge, but I got so many waves where they literally just went into a dry rock and I just got so smoked. I felt like I got less confident surfing it when it was small prior to the comp. But the wave is so sick. Like, it's so surfable for how unsurfable it looks too, if that makes sense, especially when it's got a little bit more south in it. Like, you can do spins on takeoff and then get a pretty sick ramp down the end if you want it. Like, it's, yeah, it felt more surfable when I got to surf it. Compared to how it looks, I know it's hard to explain because it's just so shallow and scary, but definitely on the right swell direction, you can really fuck with it a bit.
No, you're so right, man. You're so right. You hit the nail on the head when you said, like, it looks more scary than what it kind of is. Don't get me wrong. People have broken their backs out there. People have had, you know, career-ending injuries out there. It's definitely a serious wave, much like ship sterns or the box or any sort of waves, you know. Coney's, for example, exactly the same. But when it's small and the right swell, like you said, with a bit of south in it, don't get me wrong, you ideally want east or east southeast. Even a good straight southeast swell is great out there. But when it's south like that, yeah, you've got the chance to kind of run into a bowl at the end. You could time it from the peak to get a barrel through White Rock and then come out, and the bowl's kind of presenting itself a lot more, and you're not racing through surge as much to get out. You've got time to kind of do an innie or a backflip or a air forward or air reverse like Jacob Romero does out of there somehow. But yeah, it's it's really deceiving. I think it's got this aura around it that makes it untouchable sometimes, and people don't fuck with it in certain swells because they think it just the risk versus reward just isn't there. But it's such a user-friendly wave when you use the parts of the wave to your advantage. And I'm sure you guys got the hang of it pretty quick, knowing that, like, on those small days or those south days, you want the ones that hug. You want to kind of get that push in from the wedge. And yeah, there'll be ones that'll shut down on you, but there'll be ones that'll really give you, for how average the swell is and the conditions are, some of the best waves you'll kind of get on the coast at the time. Like, it's a special wave, man. I'm so lucky to have grown up here and experienced it. And like when I take it for granted, I often, when I hear the words you just spoke then, like it's so sick to hear from someone who's, you know, an outsider who's got so much experience in other heavy waves and then come here to the little residential town of Cronulla and see the potential that that wave has on the right days. You know, like obviously the challenge, you guys had it fucking tough, man. And it was good to get it run and great to bring it back after 6 years, but like that's not what the island should really be like most of the time. And I just wanted to touch on something you said to me, because I've told this to a couple of people, what you said to me at the Prezzo after, I'm pretty sure it was the Prezzo. You looked at me square in the eyes and you were so serious when you said this to me. And it really, it was imprinted in my memory from there on in. It was like, you looked at me and you said, I was out there today and I almost drowned. And I was just like, what? And you looked at me and was like, man, if there was a couple more waves in some of those wash through sets, I don't think I would have made it back to land. And it kind of struck me. I'm like, for how south it was and how rogue it was out there, you know, people probably didn't fully understand, unless you totally get the wave and what you're experiencing, how gnarly those conditions were. Like at times, man, that bombing was breaking out in the middle of the bay. That they were 10, 12, 15 foot lines at times. Like, can you just run us through a couple of your heats out there and what you were feeling at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely said that to you. I mean, it was so, so big towards my semis. But yeah, I mean, I'll start from the beginning. I paddled out there at about 8 in the morning just with Harley, just to kind of get a feel for the reef. And the increasing swell, because it was definitely the biggest we'd seen it that morning. And yeah, it was probably 6 foot in the morning. And Harley actually went in because he was in the first heat of the day. So he surfed for about an hour, then went in. I was out there by myself and the tide was low. So it was, most of them were pretty sketchy. And I remember just sitting in the channel and watching one come through, and probably was a 4 foot takeoff to a 6 to 8 foot M bowl. And it was definitely the best wave I saw out there all trip. And it's pretty cool to see, but it's so scary through that surge section, especially on the lower tide. Like if there's not much room for error. But yeah. And then in my first heat, I was versing Mike Stewart and Dave Winchester, and the swell kind of started really jacking at that time in the day. And it made it so tricky to kind of get the ones you want, because essentially you got these 6 to 8 foot waves coming in and they're actually pitching because they're breaking on that far end of the reef. But the waves you want to get are about 10 meters in from there too. But you got to keep in mind that there's basically a dry island on the inside of you too. So it's just made it so difficult to sit in the spot that you wanted to sit, because you had that fear of getting one on the head. And I think the heat after me, Liam Lucas paddled out, and I don't even thought he caught a wave and caught one of those on the head and snapped his leash and ended up pretty much on a dry rock. So, yeah, it was definitely nerve-wracking at times and just a bit of a mind game to get in the right spot, because there's just so much water out the back coming in at all times. It made it really, really difficult. And more so on my semi-finals. Like my semi-finals was probably, I think it was the biggest it was all day, the boys were saying from the balcony. I was looking out the back and all I could see was white water pretty much across the bay. And I was
that, like, was in the first semi, hey?
Yeah, the first semi, correct. Yeah, I think I was,
that was definitely the biggest.
Marley, Sean Pine, Michael Osler, and Jacob Romero. I believe there could have been one more person in that heat too. I might have reeled them all off, but yeah, it was just so tricky to get scores on the board, just with how many wash throughs were coming through. I think I got washed into the channel 3 times before I'd caught a wave. And there was just this one set that landed on my head that was like, it wasn't whitewater, it was actually pitching, and it was from real deep on the reef, and it just threw me off my board. I'm like, if my leash snaps and I know there's waves after this, I'm just going to end up on the reef. And I was so out of breath as well, because you're pretty much sprint paddling for I was sprint paddling for 20 minutes before that. So, yeah.
And the current was so severe too.
Yeah, watching
down the reef, that's the hardest, man. And I guess that's why you turned to me at the presentation and said that, because after 5, 6, 7 washers in a row and you're still trying to hold your position and your legs are just giving way after surfing a 40-minute heat prior to this now, like a 40-minute heat out even there, and your first heat that you made it through would have been felt like you surfed for an hour and a half just with how much water's moving in the building and rising swell. And then for you to go out there and then to compete again. And, you know, you did so well, man. Like, you know, you could tell you were analyzing the waves and you were trying to launch off the end bowl and did some really sick rolls, really projected rolls that scored really well. And then, you know, just to see what you, Pino, and, yeah, like the rest of the semi copped. Especially, the only reason I'm mentioning Pino is because I remember commentating that heat. And no, sorry, I wasn't commentating the heat. I was watching from behind the commentary box, and I was looking out and seeing Pino. And Pino's a wizard out there. Like, he knows exactly what he's doing and the waves he wants. But the amount of swell that was coming through in that semi and battering new cunts to like near death was just so crazy to see. And even himself couldn't pull himself into the zone where he wanted those good ones, or, you know, get the one wave in 10 minutes that actually did barrel across the reef in between wash through sets. So it was a full battle out there. You guys properly went to battle with the ocean that day.
Yeah, it made it reassuring seeing Pino, you know, not catch heaps during that heat too, because I'm like, he's like one of the best out there. So and his local knowledge is crazy. So if he's not catching heaps of waves, I'm like, it's definitely tricky. And it was really annoying because I had blue tack in, and my hearing's really bad at the best of times, just from growing up in Tassie having bad surfers here in both ears. So I could never hear when the buzzer went off to start a heat. So I was starting my watch like off a guess, basically. I was guessing when the heat started. And I couldn't hear scores either. So I was like, I don't know where I'm at in any of my heats or how long I've got left. I had a rough gauge on my watch, but I actually could not hear basically anything. The only time I heard something was when I landed one of them rolls and the Tassie boys was screaming from the balcony. That was basically the only thing I heard.
They erupted, man. You could hear them from all the way at North Cronulla. I reckon fellas at Northies put down their schooners and said, what the fuck was that? Like, it was crazy.
Yeah, it was great. I actually watched the live podcast back, and you can hear him in – not the live podcast, the live stream back, and you can hear him in that pretty clearly. It's pretty sick.
Oh, so sick. That's – and back to my point before, the energy that was brought from you fellas was just so good. I mean, love to have you back for next year, just, you know, obviously like for your performances, but also for that energy. It's so good to see. And that's what bodyboarding needs, and that's what the spectacle was all about, you know, like making sure that – it was seen in a challenging set of conditions, which, you know, obviously we would have liked it more east, but it was sick to see that there was still enough swell out there to keep, you know, the general bystander interested. And it was just cool to see everyone lining up on the point. And I'm sure you guys got a bit of a buzz and a kick walking back from your heats through the Esplanade, just kind of going like, wow, like, you know, especially for Australia, like bodyboarding is still alive and well when the effort and the team puts it together, because we were even blown away, like Mark, Sam, myself, of how many people turned up and who was keen to kind of throw in and help out. And so many people made that day possible, but it was so sick to see that the weather combined with like a sunny Sunday, and it was just all systems go. It was a bit like a bit of a landmark moment for Australian Boogan, especially over the last couple of years. We've had a bit of a quiet run, so it was great you could be involved.
Yeah, I mean, it was by far the biggest bodyboarding event I've ever experienced in my life for sure. I mean, I went to nationals once, but yeah, it was just ridiculous how many people were there and how many people were up there trying to get signatures off the boys. And yeah, just that many people. And like, I remember paddling out and looking back at the hill and it was just absolutely stacked, like the Colosseum or something. It was, yeah, it was very surreal. And then, you know, obviously hats off to you guys for organizing such an event. I can only imagine how many gray hairs you would have got just trying to piece everything together, making the calls for the days. And then on top of that, like all the other side events that I guess not everyone would have known about, like the wave pool and the bowls and all that. Like the wave pool was just crazy. I mean, it was like 25 of the best bodyboarders in the world all surfing at once, and it was, the level of surfing was so sick.
Oh, it was so enjoyable to be there watching that, man. We're actually going back in a day's time. So we're recording this on the 10th of July, a Wednesday. We're going back tomorrow night on the 11th of July, Thursday night, just for the SIC pool kind of party. Like it's just having like the finalists there and running through with the general public, like to be able to, you know, mix and match on the left and the right and just surf with a couple of the fellas, only for an hour just after it closes. But you're right, man, like it's one of those things you get so buzzed on because the technology's new, fairly new. It's a surreal experience under lights, and just when you've got, you know, good bodyboarders in like the one spot, all coming together and sharing the same energy and just, you know, enjoying themselves, it's yeah, it's really cool to see. And it's great to be able to link it up with a big comp that you can have those side things available. So it's almost like a bit of a festival, not just having the one-off event and you guys, you know, drive up or fly in from places and kind of, you know, not being able to just get bang for buck, so to speak. You know, like it's great to be able to surf the Island Challenge, but you want to have things around it too to keep people interested. Even like the ice bath session through the wealthy club that we did in at the comp site like a week beforehand, just doing the ice baths and the was it a week or was it a couple of days? Might have been a couple of days.
Yeah, I think it was a couple of days for the comp. Yeah.
Yeah, the ice baths and then going to the saunas at recovery and all having a yarn in there. And yeah, it was really cool. It was a bit of a different thing because most comps that I've been involved with working for Surf New South Wales and just couple other bodyboarding comps I've been to, you're kind of there just for the comp itself, and that's great. I mean, you know, having a comp in good waves and in a good location is the ideal kind of outcome, but having everything else around it just brings just a bit more of a community vibe, and you get more out of the experience than just being there for the one day.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think, yeah, having that wave pool session and yeah, all them other activities changed my perspective of the atmosphere of it. I mean, obviously when the heat gets cooled and everyone's in the water, it's a little bit different, but yeah, it just brought everyone together and everyone was just frothing, especially after the wave pool. That just kind of hit everything off with a bang. I mean, how could you not be frothing after something like that?
I know. Is that the first wave pool you've surfed, or have you surfed Melbourne?
No, it was the first wave pool I ever been to, because I basically moved to WA just when they kind of, it was really kicking off. I think like the first year it was pretty busy there and hard to get into. So, yeah, I never surfed one before and I was so excited to go in. It just feels so weird. You're like sitting in a swimming pool and then all of a sudden a perfect 2 to 3 foot wave just appears out of this triangle of the pool. It's so weird how it happens. It was so sick there. And the like fresh water too, and you're in a wetsuit and, yeah, it's a strange feeling being in a wave pool, but we were frothing after it. We actually went back and surfed the left a couple of days later. Me, Harley, my brother, and Jethro, we went back and surfed the left.
Fuck yeah. And how was that? Was that just another expert session?
Yeah, I think it was. It starts off as like progressive turns, and then for the last half, it was barreling. So
yeah, sick. Yeah, cool. I know the setting.
Yeah, I'm not sure which one it was, but yeah, it was so much fun. I really want to surf the right again because obviously I prefer rights, but it was really good surfing the left too. It's so sucky though. Like I was doing a couple spins in and it was catching me out heaps. Like it's pretty heavy, a little chew.
Yeah, man, for what it is and the product they've got going, it's definitely impressive. The only thing I would say is that, I know this is a lot of the feedback I've heard, is just make it a bit bigger, you know, because the one in Melbourne was one of the first prototypes, was the second or third one, and the one in Sydney's the 10th. And like, you would just think over that period that maybe, and I guess they're probably tapping into a market where you don't need to make it any bigger because you're getting people that don't normally surf a bodyboard in the pool and trying it out. But, you know, it'd be great just for one, and it's so much money to be piled in as an investment. So I'm sure they want to make it back. And I get it to a certain extent, but fuck, get some investors involved and make one that's like 6 foot, you know, and get people to sign waivers that show, I mean, just, you know, put no onus on the actual company or the organization who's holding the comp at the wave pool, or like the organization who's running the wave pool, and just let people go ham. Like, can you imagine 6 foot bowls out there on the end? Like, it'd be like you doing those invert air versus out conies. Like, it'd be banging.
Oh, it would be so silly if they could make one that was, yeah, 6 foot. It would change a lot of things. I mean, I don't see why they can't. I mean, I definitely think in the future they'll probably have some big wave surf event at a wave pool. But then, can you imagine how much water they would have to push? How much water would drain through the pool if they made like an 8 foot wave in a wave pool?
Oh, for sure. Can you imagine the energy then that would just expel out towards the shorelines, and how would they then, yeah, keep that energy coming back in, and how would the reverb go with like the wave, you know, creating all that whitewash? I guess you could make it deeper off the end, but the energy would still kind of travel through and wash up a wall and then come back down, and they'd have to make it a pretty big playing field, I guess. You know, the one at Yeppoon, like Surf Lakes, I don't know if you've seen that with the huge plunge in the middle.
Yeah,
that would be... Yeah, so that would be the ideal technology, because like, I feel like you've just got four waves utilized at once, you know, or like, you know, as many waves as you like, really, depending on how you set up your park. And yeah, just that big plunger, they just scale it up and scale it up and scale it up, and then just the waves get bigger and bigger from there. And yeah, because I think the technology in the wave garden is that kind of panel like snake in the middle terminal, where like the panels almost go in like a snake, like slide, or, you know, however a snake moves, and it kind of creates waves through that sort of technology. That's just like, it's obviously really good, but I mean, just for bigger waves, I think that plunger would be the go.
Yeah, the plunger seems the most legit. It's kind of gone quiet though, that project. I mean, it was ages ago that I was seeing Mitch and Ben Player and all those boys surfing it, and yeah, now I haven't heard anything from it, which is kind of, yeah, is it still operating?
I think it is, man, but rumor has it that they've run out of money to continue to push the project forward, and I think that they don't have the resources at the moment to make it a fully functional facility for the public. I think there's like things they've got to jump through safety wise, and yeah, to make sure the resources are there for power and for water and for sanitization and all that sort of stuff. That was the last I heard, that they're still kind of trying to get the funding for that, because again, a huge operation. I think it's on a way larger scale than the wave garden technology at Urban Surf. So, and also too, man, Yeppoon, like, don't get me wrong, I know the guys who came up with the idea and started the company are originally from Yeppoon, so you want it in your backyard, but fuck, mate, you could have made it closer to a major city just to utilize the you know, the growing population and like the numbers game, you know what I mean? Like, who the fuck is driving or flying up to Brisbane and then driving out to Yeppoon or wherever the closest airport is? Like, it's fucking bush, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, these wave pools, at the end of the day, it's business. Like, they got to make money to keep them going, so they've got to factor that in. So, yeah, when you said Yeppoon, I didn't even know where that was.
Exactly, man. Yeah, I only heard of it through this wave pool, and I looked it up, and we had him on the potty earlier on in the piece, in the first 20 or 30 episodes. Like, lovely crew of gentlemen and all that kind of stuff, but at the same time, yeah, just thinking it's at Yeppoon, it's just like in the middle of Queensland. Like, it's just, well, not fully the middle of Queensland, but it's just, it's kind of far up north, and it's just a little bit far away from dense civilization. So yeah, but anyway, it was really cool to have it for the Island Challenge, and I can't wait to go again. I'm actually going to surf it this Thursday, so I'm so keen to put the flippers on and actually get in there. But man, it's dropped to, I think, like 12 or 12 and a half degrees. And you boys, I think, had it at like 13.8 or 13.9, which is still really cold. But yeah, it's going to be a bit chilly.
Yeah, they definitely can get cold. I know the one in Melbourne's freezing at the moment. Like, everyone's wearing hoodies and booties and stuff surfing it. Like, you think in the future they should be able to put some kind of heating in it too. But I guess the water's moving so much, it would be hard to heat it up.
It is. And also too, I think the vast amount of it, like I do pool filtration systems myself in my business here at home, and like, you know, heat pumps and use electricity, and then there's gas, and you can obviously hook up like solar to many things, but I think it's over like 22 or 24 million litres, that pool in Sydney, and that's smaller than Melbourne. So to heat that amount of water, man, for energy costs. And I think also too, recalling to my podcast with Sean from Urban Surf, the operations manager, he was saying that they've got an agreement with Sydney Olympic Park and the council to try and be carbon neutral by a certain amount of time. So their operations essentially has to use as less energy as possible. And I just think the heating thing is just something that's going to be kind of, you know, the last thing to be addressed, because if you're looking to be carbon neutral, heating essentially is going to be one of the last things you want to tick off the box before anything else. And I guess Sydney's not too bad. Like, you get enough solar radiation and heat out, especially in Western Sydney during like 9 months of the year. It's going to be pretty sweet. We've just had a relatively cold winter for the East Coast standards this year, and I think that's why it's dropped so below. But dude, speaking about fucking cold, I only saw a photo the other day up near Ben Lomond in your home state of like rivers and lakes and waterfalls frozen over. It's been that cold in Tassie. Have you got any family back at home that have been, you know, rugging up this winter?
Yeah, I mean, Sam called me the other day and said it was the coldest day in the last 100 years or something recorded from this certain spot. I forget how many years it was, but it was a long, long time. Coldest recorded day. And I think he went and surfed rebounds that day and said it was just miserable. So it's so cold. Like, I got off the Spirit with Kira after we left Cronulla, and I think it was -5, and it looked like it was snowing. It wasn't snowing, though. It was just frost everywhere, and it's just so cold there during the winter. It's I remember it being just so tough at times, like trying to get out.
-5. So that was in the day.
It was early morning, so the Spirit gets in at about 6 o'clock. So it would have been about 7:30. And you're going for the Midlands, which is the altitude's quite high. So you're more susceptible to stuff like that. But yeah, it gets so cold there in the winter. Like, really, really cold. Like, takes the life out of you. I remember surfing shippies midwinter, and like, you get 2 wipeouts, and like, you feel like you can't breathe when you pop up.
Yeah, wow, that's psycho. I know you guys brave it down there, man. It's like other parts of the world where, yeah, you guys get way less sunlight in winter, obviously way more in summer, but, you know, winter seems to be super hard. My brother lived down in Hobart for a little bit at Tranmere, and like just across from Hobart, I guess, and they had a place there, and they were there for 2 years, I'm pretty sure, maybe a little bit longer. And he just said it's such a beautiful place, and the summer months are amazing. You can still get some really good days in like autumn and stuff, but when winter sets in, like, it properly sets in, and yeah, you know about it pretty quick, eh? Like, can you remember growing up some days, you know, trying to get yourself to the beach or the coast and going like, why the fuck am I even doing this sport?
Yeah, literally, especially when you get skunked too. But yeah, I remember once when me and Sam were really young, we ended up wearing some of our clothes under our wetsuit. We were so cold trying to put our wetties on. This is like when we were probably 13 or something. But yeah, the winters were just so rough. And I honestly don't know how we did it when we were that young, because like, we didn't have very good wetsuits. Like, they were covered in holes and stuff. But yeah, it's definitely a taxing time during the winter there. But it does come and go quite quick sometimes. Like, you blink and it's already kind of coming into the next season. But yeah, definitely at times when your alarm's going off at four or something, going up the coast or just heading down to rebounds, and yeah, you definitely question it, especially when you get a big snow dump and then rain and all the snow goes into the Derwent River, because South Arm, which is the closest beach to us, the water would go like brown, like proper brown, and it would just be all runoff from the mountain. So I think it was 9 degrees it can get down to in winter.
That's on a good so day. Cold.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's proper cold. What was it like growing up in Tassie, man? Like, you guys all seem to be pretty, you know, speaking of like your brother Sam, Harley, Charles, you know, numerous bodyboarders and surfers that are down there. Like, what's the community like growing up in the Boogan and surfing community? And what's it like just growing up in Tasmania in general?
It was epic growing up in Tassie. I mean, definitely a different vibe to the mainland. Like, I always felt like it's completely separate. I mean, it obviously is. We're separate. It's a full island now. I mean, it once was joined to Australia. Yeah, I feel like you're always about 2 years behind with anything down there. And, yeah, it's definitely hard getting to the beach, that's for sure. Like, I grew up just out of Hobart, and the closest beach with waves was probably 45 to an hour away. So it was, yeah, it felt different to like WA in a comparison. Like, living down in Dunsborough and Margaret River, you're so close to the beach and everything's so accessible and there's such variety of waves. Whereas in Tassie, the closest beachy that can get good is about an hour away. And then past that, you're driving 2.5-3 hours. It'd be like driving from, you know, down south to Perth in a WA comparison, but it's about 3 hours to some of the other spots. So definitely a lot of travel. Like, usually when you're doing a surf trip, you'll plan to go for a day or two or something, or make the weekend out of it. Yeah, a lot of travel involved, and it is fickle. Like, Tassie's very fickle state to live in. Like, there'd definitely be times where you don't get waves for a while, which does suck, but it makes it good when it is good. And definitely less crowded compared to the mainland too.
Oh man, way less crowded. I'm amazed at how many people. Like, I remember surfing South Arm one day, and there was a certain swell that was big enough to get into a beachy, like a really good beachy of yours down there, just around from rebounds. And like, I was amazed at how many people were marching down from the car park that day. Obviously, knowing it was kind of a forecast swell and stuff, but other than that, and it was on a weekend too, and close to Hobart, so I can see why. But other than that, like. You guys are surfing solo most of the time, eh?
Yeah. I mean, obviously haven't lived there for about 4.5 years now, but Sammy definitely said it's getting, has flurries of getting busier. I mean, especially at Shippies, if there's a real forecasted swell, that seems to be getting busier these days. But yeah, I've done so many trips where you'd go up the West Coast with just you and a mate, and it would just be you and them surfing for the whole time, which is pretty special. And I don't really like surfing with crowds, if I want to be perfectly honest with you. So it made it epic. And it was definitely something I had to get used to doing, moving to WA, like when Northeast was on, or like a really good session at Box and stuff. It was like, yeah, I found it really difficult to get waves when I first moved over here, especially at Northeast. Like, and it was really hard because you're looking at like the best waves you've ever seen, you know, 6 foot pumping North Point. And yet you haven't even got a good wave in 4 hours. It was definitely hard to wrap my head around, and had to change how I surfed a lot coming over and surfing these busy waves. But I've definitely adapted to it now, and it's less of an issue. But yeah, growing up in Tassie is just, yeah, I've always just enjoyed surf with not many people around. I think everyone can agree on that though. Like, it's always nice to get really good waves with just your core group of mates.
It is, man. Yeah, it really is. It's a special thing. I think it's something that is cherished in a lot of bodyboarding surfing circles, especially when you just hang out and share that lineup with just a core group of mates, and yeah, scoring epic waves. It's something you'll always remember. But you touched on a really good point there about Shippies getting busier, and obviously that's happened over the last 4 or 5 years heavily with, you know, more YouTube blogs coming out and Timbernathan, you know, in and about a lot of slabs up and down the East Coast, the West Coast and the South Coast of Australia, including Tasmania, trying to throw them all into one. What's the general consensus among the local crew there? Because you guys, you know, put in for a water safety ski down there. You guys all know each other, the bodyboarders and the surfers. You've got mad respect for one another, and there's a real camaraderie and a real good, close-knit core group of guys and girls on the odd occasion that do, you know, make bodyboarding and surfing possible down in Tasmania, because you've got to look out for one another. What's the general vibe amongst all you guys, you know, in the group chats when it comes to the Stern getting busier?
Oh, I mean, it sucks, but I guess these like the obvious swells that come early in the year with the warmer water always draw a crowd. But them big days just get sideblown out on social media. Everyone putting up photos that day and stuff, and that's just uncontrollable these days. I feel like it's just, you just got to have respect when you're out there, I guess. And like, especially growing up in Tassie, not living anywhere else, and then going to like a different surf spot that was good, like the Box or something, like you really know your place out there. Like all the locals paddle straight past you and, you know, will get any wave they want essentially. And it took me a while over here just to kind of fit into a lineup, I guess, and kind of have like a bit of respect from the locals and be able to sit, you know, at Box and not have people kind of get waves off you so easily. And then, you know, taking that back home, like, I think you got to give the locals a lot of respect. Like a lot of the boys like Marty and Charles and Sammy, like if they're out there paddling and surfing it, like they probably deserve to be up the top. And I guess they are at all surf times. But I remember Sam was telling me the other day, it was like 35 people or something trying to all paddle. And then on top of that, you got like 10 people trying to tow it. Like it gets real tricky, you know?
And bro, that takeoff spot can't handle 35 people trying to paddle. That's psycho. Like there's only, in my opinion, I've only surfed the place twice. I'm very novice at surfing ship zones, and you've obviously surfed a million times and know the reef better than most. But like, man, it seems to me there's only like a 5 or 10 meter kind of paddling zone to get the right line to get over that step. Is like, how's that possible?
Oh, I don't reckon it is. I mean, Sam just said it was carnage that day. He ended up catching waves he didn't really want to catch because you wait for a while to get a wave, and then when you're up, you kind of not able to sit where you want to sit because there's so many people there. And I think he actually got really hurt that day. Like I think he hit his head quite bad on the bottom, and obviously didn't like black out or anything, but went in afterwards and had some form of concussion afterwards and just sat there watching it for the rest of the day. And I guarantee that probably wouldn't have happened if there wasn't 35 people there and he, you know, had to navigate through a crowd before trying to put yourself on that right spot on the ledge. So is a huge factor. And I just, it's a hard one. Like everyone wants to surf and everyone wants to get fun waves, and it's such a beautiful place in the world down there. But yeah, it is hard to see it get that busy, but I just don't know what you're supposed to do about it. Like everyone wants to go surfing, everyone wants to have fun. So yeah, there's just days the locals boy live for down there, though. There's like plenty of other days when it breaks too. It's just them real blown out swells that get super tricky with crowds and stuff.
For sure, you can see them come from a mile away, and they're the ideal conditions, and everyone's just chomping at the bit like a dog filled with fucking rabies, just, you know, wanting to get down there and eat it all up. But you know, just thinking about and hearing you about talking about the crowds and everything, I was just wondering, and you know, you're a pretty nice cruisy fella, but I can only imagine there would have been some heated moments down there. Like, has there ever been a moment where you've had to tell someone to fuck off, or there's been an altercation or something?
No, I've never blown up at anyone. I know Marty had to pull someone's head in once. I don't know who it was. I only heard the story from Sam, but I think it was just a group of local boys out there. And some guy from Sydney just jumped off a ski, just got there and just paddled straight up the inside of all the Tassie boys and tried to paddle for the next wave. And Marty was like, nah, you can't be doing that around here. And yeah, I probably told him in the most humble way possible that he shouldn't really be doing that. But no, I've never seen a big blow up out there. I've definitely seen two people accidentally catch the same wave at once. Like I saw Sam catch a wave and with one of the local stand-up surfers, Mikey Brennan. But no, I've honestly never seen a bad blow up out there, which is really good.
Yeah, that is epic, and that's a good track record for the place because, yeah, those really heightened situations and environments in waves of consequence can often result in things like that. So it's cool to see that it's all been pretty low-key and everyone's, for the most of the time, being respectful and all that kind of stuff. I guess, yeah, as you said, you can't control the crowd, so something you've got to navigate. But, yeah, well, and also thinking about Chippies, Cohen, like what's the best wave you've had out there and what's the worst wipeout you've had out there?
Ooh, good question. I probably got two waves that were a standout for me there. One of which was on a strike mission I did back, I think it was 2022 maybe. And it was just me and Marty out there. It would have been just off first light, so it probably would have been maybe 7:38 in the morning. And yeah, it was just me and Marty paddling, and I think Sam was
in dead of winter.
Yeah, it would have been. I think it was July, so around this time of year. So yeah, pretty cold. And it was like the best ones I won out there. Like usually don't have much lead in, but will have like a really big wall on them. Which is kind of the scary ones to go because it takes a while to kind of trust the reef because they honestly look like a closeout half the time. And I remember Marty like looked at the wave and was encouraging me to go heavily. And yeah, it basically just had a perfect chip in for a bodyboard. I don't think he could catch it because he was on a stick, and I think you just get that little bit more power on a bodyboard with your fins and you're able to get into it a bit differently. But yeah, it was probably a 6-foot takeoff to a 10-foot end bowl, and I felt like I was way too deep and then made it. So that was probably one of the best ones I've had out there for sure. But I've had a couple close, you know what I mean? So, but that's probably the best one I've ever had out there for sure. And luckily enough, one of my mates filmed it too from water.
That's it. Was that in that wee bodyboard clip that they put up with all of your fellas' best waves?
Possibly. I mean, I forget. I might not have even seen the clip. I have seen that clip. I don't think it was actually. I think my friend Talon filmed it on his Red. It would have been the last clip in Coco Gone West. Yeah, it was the last clip in that video, and that was a pretty memorable one for me because especially the ways you don't think you're gonna make and then you do make. I spent like a couple of weeks in Tassie. And then I was supposed to go back to work, and I called in sick and then got an extra day off just to go to Shippies because this swell kind of lined up for my last day there. And I was like, felt like a bit of added pressure too. And then that was literally the first wave I got. And I was like, oh, I was done. Like I could get it going now and be happy. And it was all worth it. Sometimes it's stressful when you're like calling sick for work or like change stuff, like to go surfing. It puts that added pressure that you got to get a good one.
Far out. That's such a good call too, to call in sick and whatever and just make kind of, you know, it worth your while there and bang for buck, knowing that, you know, you're not always going to get shippy swells and then to get one of the best waves of your life out there. It's so psycho. And it's so funny to hear you say that it looked like a closeout because so many waves around the world, you hear some of the best bodyboarders and surfers speak of their best ones. Honestly seemed like a closeout. Like a prime example I'm sure everyone's thinking of right now is Michael Novy's wave at the right. Like that wave, from all reports, from the horse's mouth, Michael Novy was like, I thought Damo towed me into a closeout and I was bracing for detonation. And like, you know, we all know that that wave is one of the most serious waves in the world, if not the most serious for pound water behind it. And you know, like how it detonates and how it's been treating people in the past and I'm sure in the future when it comes to beatings. Like when he let go of the rope, he thought it was a dead set close out, and he's come through it, backdoored it perfectly. It's quite possibly one of the best waves ever ridden out there on a bodyboard. And then you come to your comments in of your best waves at Chippies and you think it's a closeout. I know Chris James often spoken about a reef near his house, his place down in Wollongong, that the best ones out there are closeouts. You go to Chopes, same thing there, that crazy West Bowl that comes in, it feels like it's a closeout, but all the energy wraps in so hard. And if you take that right line, you're going to scoot out of the channel before it closes out of the reef passage. The island's also the same. Cape's a little bit different. I wouldn't say Cape feels like you're going to pull into a closeout. Like, that wave's pretty mechanical for how many imperfections it does have at the backwash. It seems like the good ones always look like they're the makeable ones. But, like, yeah, just funny to see how that's a reoccurring theme in big wave surfing, that, yeah, the closeouts are the best ones.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I guess, just trusting the reef and having that knowledge that it is going to go good, but it also is a risk too. But I don't think Shippies can close out in that same sentence. But yeah, that wave Novi got it the right is just silly. I mean, I can only imagine how nervous he probably would have been towing into that thing. It was so big and he was so deep and just threaded it so well. Yeah, I think that's probably the wave of his life too, I can only imagine. He also got a pretty deep one that day too, which is pretty crazy footage of that I think surfaced on the internet not too long ago. But yeah, it's usually the case at most spots. Maybe it's just because there's more energy on the end bowl, so it's going to flare more. But yeah, it definitely took me a while to start trusting catching those waves out there, because yeah, they're pretty daunting pushing yourself over the ledge when it does look like a closeout.
So it's got to put time and more time in at those waves, don't you? And then when you've paid your dues and you've sorted out the lineup and you've got the confidence to understand how many or what waves break where and whatever, it's just so cool to see that, yeah, you can capitalize on it and get one of the waves of your life. But we didn't get to your worst wipeout, mate. What was the worst wipeout out the stern?
Oh, yeah. I was actually just thinking that too. My worst wipeout was probably, it was a really busy day out there. Not crazy busy, but busy enough to the point where, there was a couple tow teams and a fair few paddle teams. I think it was the day Russell Burke got that really crispy one at the end of one of his clips, not his recent clip, but the one before, if that springs to mind.
Yeah, it definitely does. And it's the one that did he tow it or he paddled it? Was it flow state?
Maybe. I forget the name of his clip, but he definitely paddled it. And it was like,
oh, dude, it's the most psycho one where he knifes underneath and it flares and just misses the step. It draws this perfect line where he made the unmakeable pretty much.
Yeah. It was, it was such a good wave. But yeah, it was that day. It was probably midday. And I'd caught a wave and I was paddling back out and a set came and I think Spud was towing it. One of the stand-up guys, I think he's from Europe somewhere. He was towing it and I was like, hadn't quite made it to the back of the lineup yet. And he pulled off and caught the whole lineup by surprise, because they obviously weren't going to paddle for it when he was towing, like he was up.
Are you and talking about Ignacio? Off.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's
in Cronulla. I know the guy you're talking about. He's like South American, Privian or something.
And yeah,
he
does yeah. A bit
of, yeah, yeah.
There's like a real funny photo of him at Cape Solander with his hands up in the air.
I know the one.
Yeah. It's amazing. If you zoom in on his face, it's so funny. But yeah, he pulled off like last minute and I have no idea why, because it was like perfect offshore, very green swell. And I was, just at the tail end of the lineup and just turned around, like didn't look down the line. I just turned around and pretty much was on the wave instantly and just airdrop top to bottom and got kind of fell off like right at the bottom of the step. Like I was actually on my back, like, because I airdropped, and I remember Harley saying like, never ditch your board on an airdrop, because you definitely won't make the wave if you throw your board away. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty good advice. So I remember just holding on to it, but I was like, I pretty much did a roll like from the top and landed on my back, and I was kind of sick at the time, so I had my sinuses were real blocked up. And I remember just getting sucked over in the lip, hitting the bottom, and then popping up and I think I'd blown a blood vessel in my head or something. So I came up with like a pretty bad blood nose and stuff. But I think it was just from like the pressure of being sick, you know, when you can't dive under the water because you can't equalize.
I know exactly the feeling you're talking about, and all the pressures like in your nose and your forehead and stuff.
That was probably my worst, but it wasn't too bad. Like, Harley's had some horrific wipeouts out there. Like, he caught one and then someone towed it. I think Holmacross towed it, and they kind of got caught. Like, he had to stall because the stick whipping was in front of him, and he basically had to stall and change completely how he was surfing the wave, and it was a bomb too. And he basically got knocked out underwater and got a two-wave hole down. And so, yeah, in comparison to some other people's wipeouts, it's been fine. Like, I was just underwater for a while. But even Charles got stuck in a cave out there once.
Dude, I was just about to bring that up. Like, obviously Harley's is fucked up too. Two-wave hole down, it's disgraceful. But I couldn't, and that can be life-changing. That can stop people surfing those waves. And I know Harley's an absolute beast, so he's continued on. But when Charles told me that story, I was actually down shippies for one of the times, and like, man, he told me that before we paddled out, and I'm just like, fuck off. You know what I mean? Like, don't say this to me before we're going to go surf one of the gnarliest waves in the world, because I got no idea what I'm doing out there. Now you freak me out even more about catching waves. I caught two waves that whole fucking session because it was still in my fucking head. And that's not his fault. He was just having a yarn, but I'm just saying, like, the ferociousness of the story itself, and just how scary that must have been to be caught in a cave and not knowing where we were, like, which way is up, and having to change course and look for the light and all sort of stuff, like, whilst you're deep underwater trying to hold your breath and not knowing where the next set wave is going to come. Like, oh man, it just sends shivers down my spine. It's one of the most scary things and frightening things I've ever heard. It's fucked up.
Yeah. I was out there that day. I think the footage of that session's in, it's a found clip. It's a while ago now. It was like George Humphreys out there and me and Harley. And it was up until, I think I was 18 at the time, and that was the best I'd ever surfed it. And it was proper grunt, like south swell down there. And I don't even think the wave was that big. It was probably only 6, maybe bigger than 6 foot, maybe 8 foot. And it was really long and south. And yeah, he pretty much got flogged and the tide was low and he just got sucked into this cave and was completely stuck in there. And he couldn't see anything. And he was, I think he got to the point where he was just literally punching rock walls to try to get out. And then I think the next wave came and sucked him out backwards, and yeah, got so lucky to get ripped out of there by the following wave. And he obviously went in afterwards. And I remember going to the rocks and seeing him later that day, and his hands and feet were just so swollen and so cut up. I think we had to help him carry his board out. I think someone had to drive his car back because he was just so banged up from it and pretty rattled too, obviously.
And what a credit to the man to be able to conquer those internal demons and go back out and surf it again. Like, talk about falling off the horse and getting back straight back up on it again. Like, that takes mental fortitude, eh? Like, fucking hats off to the bloke. That is a beating. Like, for example, right, I mentioned Ryan Maddock twice in this potty, but I'll go with this again. Like, he stopped bodyboarding from that beating at the left, at Supers, you know what I mean? When he fell top to bottom and his life flashed before his eyes, and that's when he kind of started his drag, and we started Zion and drag, and you know, I think Zion might have been started before then, but anyway, like he moved more into the retail space and creating products and really hung up the fins for good. Jake Stone cops that massive beating at the right. After that crazy way that he towed, he knew, got sucked up the face, somehow survived relatively unscathed and kind of gave away bodyboarding after that too, knowing that, like, he had nothing else to prove and he wanted to go and pursue other things. you know, for Charles then to just put the flippers back on and go get some more meaty ones out there still to this day, and I'm sure he'll continue into the future. Man, it takes a special human, eh? Like, it's really impressive.
Yeah, and I guess you don't know how you're going to feel after that situation until it happens to you. But, yeah, he seemed – I think he was surfing it within a month afterwards. I'm sure he didn't let it off. I'm sure he would have thought about it a lot kind of coming into surfing it again. But, yeah, it almost seemed like a couple of days later he was fine. But, yeah, it's pretty scary, those kind of moments. I think even, like, there was a grommy back in the day who thought Walu broke his jaw out at Supers too, and I heard that, you know, pretty much stopped him Bergen too, from what I hear.
Yeah, thought Walu. Yeah, he was an absolute pocket rocket, like a real up and coming next big kind of thing. And he was, you know, touted as the next Tom Rigby. He was really good mates with Sam Strachan at the time, and Sam Strachan, Sean Pine, and Ryan Hutt, three of my really good mates, were there at that session and actually had to get him into the rocks. And other Bra boys were there too. And I remember Strachan saying something disgraceful about Kobe and the way he treated him that day when Thorpe was like banged up on the rocks and close to having a near-death experience and breaking his jaw and, you know, doing his backing and stuff. And yeah, I won't go into too much more of that, but I don't want to tell the story wrong. But like from all reports, it was just such a wild event, and those are those waves in people's lives where sometimes you just don't come back from it, because it's like, is it worth the risk? And this is the risk versus reward kind of argument and kind of, you know, internalized mental battle that a lot of people have on like a regular basis. It's like, do I want to push myself over the ledge there, because is the reward going to be worth the risk? And yeah, to see people go out and still do it and after they've had those beatings just shows how much they love bodyboarding or love surfing and want to just continue on. It's pretty wild, man. And even think of the waves that you caught in Coco Gone West, man, you know what I mean? And like especially that one at Coney's is in that clip, hey, that ridiculous 10-foot one that you thread in behind and just it goes so square and you couldn't be any deeper. Is that one in that clip?
That one's in From Dusk to Dawn.
Yeah, and like when you think about that clip, man, like both those clips are amazing. You know, and that wave really kind of showed to us at the SIC committee, you know, Mark, Sam, myself, that you were so worthy of being in the Island Challenge, because for anyone who knows that wave and the injuries, you know, Nick Ormrod, Dylan Longbottom, plenty of other people that have come to grief out there. It just shows your commitment. It just shows how much you want it and how much you love catching those sort of waves and the amount of energy and time and effort you put into thinking about those sessions and preparing for them and wanting the best out of them. So it's, yeah, it's a feather in your cap, man, because like that wave is, it's a pretty special wave. Probably couldn't have been any deeper on that thing, eh?
Yeah, it was that day was so it was probably the best I've surfed it. It was that's a lie. I've definitely surfed it better, but yeah, it was the afternoon. We'd surfed it all morning. So we surfed it for like 4 hours in the morning, and then the tide got lower and we went back out in the afternoon, and I was up and the set came through and I knew Sammy really wanted it, but I was kind of in a better spot and he'd been waiting longer, so made me more keen to catch it because I knew how much Sam wanted it. But yeah, I thought it was a really short wave when it came through, because it came through as like a big wedge, and I was like, oh, like I won't need to pin it too much because it looked short. And then by the time I put my head down and actually paddled into the wave, it went really, really long. And it was, I remember I was like, oh, I've got to really like get a good rail on and get a good drive through it. Otherwise I'm definitely not making this. And it was dead low tide too. And I remember getting to the bottom and I could see the reef like spinning under my board, like it was pretty shallow. So yeah, I definitely gave it my all to make it, because yeah, it is such a shallow reef out there. Like if you look at the wave, it breaks almost a kilometer out to sea, and it'll break the whole way to the beach. Like the reef will follow the wave in all the way to the beach. So it's got these really shallow spines, and and holes in the reef too. Like if you look at all the rocks around there, you can kind of get a pretty good understanding of the topography. So yeah, it's not a wave you want to fall off on. Thankfully, I've only hit the bottom once out there and it was pretty sweet, but almost every time I've gone there, someone's gone to hospital just from hitting the bottom. It's just so, so sharp out there. And yeah, it's not very forgiving. So, and like, that's, I mean, like when I saw Longbottom catch that wave, it was like, what are you doing? Like it's 0.2 low tide and it was pretty much already washing down from the other side of the reef. It was, yeah, it's pretty scary wave and you've got to definitely try to have a fair bit of respect for it out there.
Definitely, man. Yeah, you're so right. And I've said this numerous times too. You hit the nail on the head when you said, when you look around at the surrounding rock faces and you see the way they're shaped and formed, there's no doubt in my mind that that's exactly what that reef looks like underneath. And it's just, it's uneven, it's jagged, it's sharp, it's unforgiving, like you said, and just, yeah, it creates one of the most perfect waves going around for heavy wave kind of bodyboarding. And you know, we've also seen through yourself and Tristan Roberts and Nick Gornell and Pierre-Louis Costes, you know, anyone who can launch in the air. It's got an amazing air bowl in it, but comes at such a price, you know. And again, the risk versus reward thing, you know, it comes into play, but it's, yeah, all credit has got to go to yourself and to people who want to go surf and hit those bowls and ride those sorts of waves, because yeah, you're a long way from anywhere out there as at the stern and as at the right and a lot of places in Australia. And it's, yeah, you're really putting your neck on the chopping board, so to speak. It's epic. And when you look at that, those clips, Coco Gone West and From Dusk Till Dawn, like there's just so many waves in there that that just shout that sort of attitude. And what's it been like making those clips? And I know, you know, Sam and yourself, you know, cut and edit all your own clips, which is another feather in your guys' caps. Like what's the feeling behind looking through all the footage and putting, you know, your own creative flair on your own surfing? It must be pretty special.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoy the creative process. I mean, I've always liked doing it, but for so many years, me and Sam just had a rusty old Mac and just had iMovie, which doesn't really allow you to fully express yourself too well through it. I mean, I think I edited Coco Gone West on iMovie, but yeah, recently got a new Mac and I bought Final Cut Pro through the Mac as well. So having that good software is epic. And yeah, I really, really do enjoy making clips and doing the editing. Like from Dusk Till Dawn, I think like all the paper scrunching and all them, like a lot of the special effects I put in were all like, they're all green screens, and basically I'd like print out the titles and the photos and cut them out and then do basically a stop motion animation over a green screen and then scan them for a printer and put them back in. It was actually so much effort, but I managed to do some of it on night shift at work. So yeah, but it took me a long time to do, but I really enjoy doing it. If I have the time though, you got to have time to do it. Like, some of these projects take weeks and weeks to do.
And how do you fill up your time, man? Like, you know, what do you do for coin on the side of bodyboarding there? And how do you juggle your other extracurricular activities and just life, you know, responsibilities with chasing good waves?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely hard. I mean, bodyboarding doesn't really pay the bills, so you got to have some other avenue to get income. I actually work up on a mine site, an iron ore mine site, and I'm basically in a fire rescue department on the mine. So, yeah, we basically, anytime there's an emergency, we have like an ambulance. We've got two big fire tenders, and then we've got like a light tanker, which is just for bushfires. And yeah, basically manage an emergency service department up there. It's a pretty weird job. It's like, it's because like, there's so many different disciplines that we cover, like rescue disciplines that we cover. So it's like an ambulance. It's almost like a paramedic and a firefighter, and then we also do vertical rescue as well. So it's like you wear a lot of hats up there, and you kind of expected to know a fair bit of different disciplines and stuff. But it's a really good job. It's the best job I've definitely ever had. And I do a week on, week off roster, which is pretty good. So essentially, if I don't take leave, I'm only working 6 months a year. But usually every year I'll probably take a month or two off. So it's good in that sense. Like I can usually surf a fair bit and do a fair few trips as well. But sometimes you're getting bad rotations up there. Like when you're away for a week and it's good, and then you get home and it's bad for that week, you're home and then you go to work again. It's like all of a sudden it's 3 weeks and you haven't got good waves, and that definitely takes a toll on things.
Yeah, for sure, man. I've heard that from so many shift workers and FIFO guys. It's like, yeah, if you're one of my good mates, Damien Miller, who lives up on the Goldie, he does some work out in the some of the Queensland mines as environmental scientist or engineer. I can't remember exactly the title. I'm sorry, Damien, I've probably fudged that, brother. But yeah, he said there's times where he'll come back to the Goldie and it'll be northerlies and flat and fucked, and then he'll go away and then an east swell or south east swell will spring up and the winds go trade south or southwest and all the points are lighting up. And he used to be a bodyboarder that still boogs every now and again when the sand's right at snapper, but mainly surfs now, and he just gets so disgruntled and fucking off it because he's just not in that rhythm and that flow. And I guess that's the hardest thing. Like, you know, having the week off is amazing, and working a week straight is epic too, because you get it out of the way and then you got more spare time. But yeah, if you're not in that flow and swing of things, and the ocean can be pretty cruel like that sometimes, it's a mind fuck, eh?
Yeah, yeah, it sucks. I've definitely had some pretty grim swings up there where the swell's pumping back in WA or Tassie or something, and I can't be there. But yeah, it sometimes it works in your favor too. Like sometimes every time you're home, it's pumping, and then you go back up to work and it's terrible. So it can definitely work in your favor too. But I feel like after almost 5 years of doing it, I'm pretty happy. I actually put my resignation letter in 2 days after the comp. So I'm pretty excited to get out of the mine for a bit and just have a bit more time at home and a bit more time to travel and stuff like that. So, but it serves its purpose. Like I'd never be able to do all the trips I could do if I didn't have, you know, that kind of financial support from that job. So yeah, definitely had its purpose, but yeah, it can get a bit tough when you're missing out and stuff. And it's just that added thing, like going away for work as well. Like it's not like you're going around the corner and can be home every night. Like you got to get up at 4 and go get a plane. It takes you like a day travel to get out there. And then yeah, you're pretty remote out there, and I don't think it's the lifestyle for everyone. But yeah, Harley actually works on the mine site too, so it helps when you got friends out there that you can hang out with after work and stuff.
How does Kira cope with it, man? Because it must be hard having a chick at home that you can only see 1 week on, 1 week off. Like, has it ever put any strain on the relationship?
Oh yeah, she tries to get me to call in sick for almost every swing. yeah, she doesn't froth on it when I go back, but it's like when I'm home, like I've got so much time, like it's a whole week off. So yeah, it's a catch 22, I guess. But yeah, it is tough. And I know like some people struggle who have like families and stuff like that. Like the roster's maybe not quite suited to someone with like, you know, kids and stuff like that. So it's more something I could probably do when I'm younger and don't have as many responsibilities.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Lap it up now and enjoy the lifestyle, man. Because yeah, definitely, when you got a family waiting at home, it'd be probably even more strain. Like when you've got your chick, I mean, it still puts strain on, but you can kind of navigate and work around it. But yeah, when you got family members dependent on you, wouldn't sound like the easiest job anyway. But man, I was wanted to end on something that I got told by Harley the other day, just in an off-topic conversation that really struck me, and I can definitely see it in your bodyboarding immensely now when I look back at it all and was kind of made aware of it. He says you're one of the most dedicated boogs he's ever met when it comes to like chasing swells, analyzing your footage, making sure that you're perfecting, you know, your style with your moves and trying to progress further forward with your bodyboarding. Like, you know, I mean, he even made the example of like a couple of times he's gone to bring a surfboard on a trip and you're just like, leave that at home. How fucking dare you put this in the car? We're going bodyboarding and all that kind of stuff. Like, is that true? And what is the, what's the mindset behind that when it comes to your bodyboarding?
Yeah, it's funny you said that. Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, it's good to be, I think I just really thrive on having the outlet of surfing, and it's kind of kept me always having a good focus in life, I guess. Like, if I didn't surf, I don't know what I'd be doing right now. I probably would have partied a lot when I was younger, more than usual anyway. But yeah, I guess it's just good to get progression in your riding and see yourself get better and better over time. And it's so good always filming and stuff and seeing what you're doing wrong and stuff like that. I mean, I think I got more critical with my surfing once moving to WA. I mean, I feel like the atmosphere growing up in Tassie was like, if you were dedicated to bodyboarding or like love bodyboarding, you'd surf shippies, and that was pretty much it. But then coming over here, it's like, you know, I'm surfing like Louis and George, Ben Veach, and, you know, all these boys over here. It's like pretty technical. Like, you, if you do a flip and don't cross your legs, it's not really the best thing. And like, especially surfing Mandarin with those boys, like Louis doing 720s out there. Like, so I guess lately I've definitely critiqued myself more and more. But I think that just happens naturally as, you know, you progress and stuff like that.
Yeah, cool. It's really cool to hear that you have that passion and that drive, because that's going to create such an environment, which it already has, already harbored so many good things in your career, but it'll keep pushing you forward. And I think that's what some of the greats have, man. And, you know, I'm sure you're destined for further and bigger and better things. And you've got to keep dropping these clips. You've got to keep surfing these comps. And I know, you know, you've got some things in the pipeline that are going to really blow up in the next 6 months. So stoked to have this chat with you and kind of hash out a lot of those thoughts and experiences. And I'm sure we're going to be chatting again very soon, Coco.
Yeah, no, it's likewise. It's been so good to jump on the potty. It's the first one I've ever done. So, yeah, I know we talked in Sydney about organising one, but our life was pretty busy then after the comp, and you just had a newborn as well, which congratulations again on that.
Thank you, sir.
But, yeah, frothing for the future and to keep, you know, making clips and surfing and just having fun, really, because that's what it's all about. Like, I was speaking to Anthony, I think, at the bowls about, you know, bodyboarding and stuff, and you just got to have fun with it. Just not take it too seriously. It's because the reason you did it in the first place was just for pure joy. So try not to get lost in all the other bullshit that happens with it.
Oh, mate, cut out the politics and just bring back core Boogan, eh? That's what I say.
Yeah, yeah. It's the reason you did it in the first place. So I think Toby Player had a pretty cool board from back in the day, which I think he wrote Surf for Fun on the bottom of it. And I think, yeah, definitely thought about that a lot lately. Like, just got to do it for why you started it in the first place. And that's just hanging out with your mates at the beach and having fun with it, not taking it too seriously. I mean, as much you do at times, like, you just got to always bring it back to just enjoyment.
Man, that's a great legacy to leave the combo on. It's a great legacy for everyone out there listening to kind of take on board too. No true words have been said, man, and that's it. It's for fun, and bodyboarding should, you know, with its professional side, also just be still like every professional sportsman or athlete, just doing it for the passion and the love. So, well in, Cohen. And, Braz, thanks so much for coming on the potty, and I'll speak to you shortly, bro.
Yeah, thanks so much, dude. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Cheers, bro.
You. It was all a pipe dream. Watching body.